Hey, Prime members, you can listen to That Scene with Dan Patrick ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
Just a heads up, this is an interview with Bill Burr, so there's some strong language in this episode that may not be suitable for all audiences.
Hey, okay, I get it. I'm a little particular about my personal space, too. So let's just do this job. We get in, we get out, and you don't have to see our faces anymore.
Someone tell me why we even need a Mandalorian.
Well, apparently they're the greatest warriors in the galaxy. So they say.
Then why are they all dead?
I did get some crap about my accent, where someone's like, I've never heard a Boston accent in outer space. And I was just like, well, how about English? Doesn't it seem weird that they're all speaking English?
Welcome to That Scene with me, Dan Patrick, an Amazon original podcast where I get to talk to Hollywood's top actors and directors about some of the most iconic scenes that have defined their careers, helped shape the cinematic landscape, and even become fixtures in pop culture. On today's episode, we're joined by stand-up comedian and actor Bill Burr. Born in Canton, Massachusetts in 1968, began performing stand-up in 1992, eventually moved to New York City in 1994, where his career began to take off. Bill has filmed and recorded 6 comedy specials, and in 2019, his comedy special Paper Tiger was nominated for an Emmy for Best Comedy Album. As his comedy career exploded, Bill began to branch out. In 2015, he created and starred in the Netflix animated sitcom F is for Family. He's also appeared in a slew of movies and TV shows, including Breaking Bad and the Star Wars series The Mandalorian, where he plays bounty hunter Miggs Mayfeld. The scene in question today comes during Season 2, Episode 7 of The Mandalorian, where Miggs and Mando have snuck into an Imperial fortress, and Miggs blows their cover by shooting an Imperial officer. Mandalorian. You don't strike me as a Star Wars guy. How does Mandalorian happen?
Mandalorian happened through Kevin Costner. Mike Binder was doing a movie with Kevin Costner called Black or White, and they were looking for like his sort of sidekick buddy lawyer in the movie. And I happened to be on Conan. So I would say it was Conan and Andy Richter. They put me on the show. Mike Binder saw me on the show, calls Kevin. He goes, this is the guy. This is this guy's vibe. Will work great with what you're doing. I got onto that movie, and through doing that movie, became friends with Mike Binder. Mike Binder's friends with Jon Favreau. Mike Binder has a birthday party turning, you know, we'll say 29 years old, right? So I go to his birthday party. Jon was there, and he said, hey, you know, I'm doing a reboot of the Star Wars thing. We have an idea for a bounty hunter. We had you in mind. Do you want to do it? And I laughed. I said, man, I've done nothing but make fun of Star Wars on my podcast forever. He goes, I know, I listen. He goes, I think it would be funny and your fans would get a kick out of you're in it. Unfortunately, my lovely wife was there, Nia, and she was kicking me under the table going, do it. And I was like, all right, yeah, you know, I'll give it a shot. If I knew that John was going to be doing this spaghetti Western version of it, I mean, I love Blade Runner and stuff like that. And I feel like this thing lives more than that. You know, I did get a rep that I hated Star Wars. It wasn't what it was.
They're all talking about the Force and Chewbacca. And all of that.
You hadn't seen it?
No, I did. I never saw it. I saw it later. By the time then, I was too old. And I was like, this is like a cheesy self-help book put in outer space with like Muppets. Like, I really don't. No, I know. I don't get it. I don't get what. I missed it. You got to be a kid, right? You guys all saw it when you were a kid.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't.
You didn't see it.
I had perspective. Like, I saw it when I was like 27. I was just like, ah, it's all right.
I was just doing the comedian thing. I just saw a group of people loving something, so I attacked it, you know, because of the lack of hugs I got as a child. That's basically what every comedian does. They just see, oh, you're really into that? And they just trash it. Why should you feel joy when I don't? It's a really mature way to live your life. So that's basically, you know, when people were all excited about the Star Wars reboot and they were dressing like, you know, Chewbacca and stuff. Like, I mean, it was for a comedian, it was a layup, you know, get a life. And I was just doing all of that stuff. So anyway, I went down to go do the thing and I still didn't have any idea of the scope of it until my last day. We were in this thing, they call it the volume. You walk in when you do it, it's 300, they close it behind you. It's 360 degree screen. And it's the weirdest thing where you don't move. They shoot this footage, but if the camera moves behind you, the stuff moves like that past you. You start getting like vertigo, like you're going to fall over. Well, anyway, I was standing up on this rig for the final thing that they were shooting. And he goes, "Hey, Bill, I just finished the trailer. You want to see it?" And I'm like, "All right." You know, and I'm thinking it's going to live somewhere between Star Wars and the Great Muppet Caper. Like, you know, I'd have no idea. You know, everybody's got costumes on and stuff. So he showed the thing. And the only thing missing in the trailer was Clint Eastwood, you know, the stranger. And I was like, "Oh, my God." And I remember then I had this panic. I was just like, "Oh, man, I hope I was good in this."
Yeah, well, Mayfeld, he's one of the best trigger men I've ever seen. Former Imperial sharpshooter.
That's not saying much.
I wasn't a stormtrooper, wise-ass.
And you don't want to upset that fan base.
Oh, dude, nerds are relentless. They are so much meaner than sports fans. Sports fans, like, bust your chops and stuff. Like, you know, nerds, I mean.
What was the reaction? Do you remember if there was, like, a visceral reaction you got?
Oh, when I was in it?
Yeah.
I've gotten pretty much nothing but positive reviews. I did get some crap about my accent, where someone's like, "I've never heard a Boston accent in outer space." And I was just like, "Well, how about English?" Doesn't it seem weird that they're all speaking, that you would travel that far away from Earth and everyone's speaking English? C-3PO has an English accent. It's like, stop it. You just know that that's where I'm from. Because the reality is I don't have a Boston accent. I have a slight one. But I have an East Coast sort of, at this point, like, you know, I've had people go, "You're from Jersey, you're from Long Island, Boston, Philly." I'm not saying people from there. They know. People from there know. But, you know, my bio's out there, so people know I'm from there. But they're making it seem like I was, you know, out there being like, you know, "Dude, grab your lightsaber."
How about your scene with Baby Yoda?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The one where I got crap for dropping it. But then thankfully, Jason Sudeikis punched it and he took all the heat off of me. So I'm going to thank him for that one day. He got the nerds off my back. Yeah, that was in defense of my character. I dropped him because the guy upstairs driving the ship slammed on the brakes, right? Without warning anybody.
Whoa. What is that?
You get lonely up here, buddy? Huh? Wait a minute. Did you two make that? Huh? What is it, like a pet or something?
Yeah, something like that.
Baby Yoda was absolutely adorable, except for the mechanical one that moved. That thing was beyond creepy. Beyond creepy. Because the other thing was just a cute little stuffed animal you get for your kid. But the one that actually moved had some weight because there was a motor in it. And it looked like a little old man. And it was green. It was super creepy.
Did you keep anything from that scene?
Did I keep anything? You know what's funny? Is they sent me some Baby Yoda thing. And I never even opened it up. And my sister-in-law is an absolute Star Wars freak. So I gave it to her. I got such a kick out of it. She did like a little happy dance when she got it and everything like that. So yeah, I didn't take anything. No, I don't think you'd be allowed to. I think you'd get shot. I mean, it's like super secret stuff over there. You got to wear like cloaks, you know, when you go outside, because they don't want anybody with like drones to try to see what the characters look like. Yeah, but that's one of the most fun gigs I do. And Brendan Wayne is the one who plays Mando, like when you're shooting him, and he's John Wayne's grandson, and he walks like the Duke. So that's another reason why when I saw that whole spaghetti western, I think subconsciously I was watching the lineage of one of the great screen cowboys of all time. So
and then you shoot the Imperial officer.
Oh, yeah. That was what I loved about that was something that I kind of learned in acting is you don't not to play the what, you play the why. If you play the what, it's just sort of super. I'm mad. I'm happy. I'm disappointed. But if you get into the why, you try to, you know, even if you have to make it up, this backstory thing, like why this person goes into this scenario, makes these decisions, and it plays out this way, where somebody else would go into the exact same scenario and play it out something differently. You know, just the writing of that. Rick Famuyiwa, who directed both episodes I was in, who did that movie Dope. I was a huge fan of that movie. I've been really lucky where there's a lot of things. Most of the acting gigs that I have, people will say like, "Oh man, you did such a good job in that." I always say, "You would have done a good job in it." Because it was written the way it was. All you have to do is say what they write and stop where they tell you to stop. And then they're going to put some music on it under it. You're going to look like a champ. You know, I've been really, 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 really lucky, ridiculously lucky.
Is Miggs Mayfield coming back?
Mayfeld. I called him Mayfield for the first year, too. I don't know. I hope he is. because now that they wrote all that great backstory, or maybe he doesn't. And I end with people wishing he did, which is a great place to be. I don't know. They left me in the woods on some planet. I don't know. Sci-fi and soap operas, you never, characters come back, man.
I remember you were on the Chappelle Show a long time ago.
Yes. A lot of hair ago.
The racial draft?
Well, Rob, some of the biggest names in sports and in entertainment are on the line tonight. And I'm excited to see who's going to be drafted by which race. Seated behind me on the stage there are the various representatives. And believe it or not, the blacks have actually won the first pick.
Wow, that's the first lottery a black person's won in a long time, Billy.
Yes, and they'll probably still complain.
But did you consider yourself an actor back then or wanting to be an actor back then?
The second one. Yeah, wanting to be an actor. I was taking acting classes with this woman, Joanna Bexson, right around that time, I believe, in New York City. And I think I had a lot of anxiety, which is what drove me into this business. So it's funny, my first 8 years of stand-up, if I was ever to unearth those VHS tapes, like it is just, I just paced the stage the entire time. And the movement has nothing to do with what I'm talking about. It's just all flop sweat and just moving all around. And then I think after doing stand-up and getting comfortable, I slowed down there. But then I have this weird thing where it's not like I achieve something in one area and then it translates to something else. Like whatever new thing I try, I go right back to being, you know, 8-year-old me with the bright orange hair getting beat up at recess. I go right back to that guy. So I have to like start going back up the mountain again. So when I first started, doing Chappelle's Show, I was trying to learn, how to do it. And I was in awe of how free Dave was and some of the other actors I got to work with who had, you know, Dave was just like a natural, but like some of the other people, character actors, like the levels, the different, you know, like a mixing board, they could bring stuff up and pull stuff down and whatever energy you wanted, 12 versions of high energy, 12 versions of medium energy and stuff. They just really, I learned a lot watching them.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
When it comes to hiring, don't go searching for the one. Just meet your match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
But does, when you're on stage, how much are you acting? Like, do these acting classes help you when you're doing stand-up?
No. Yeah, it's kind of a different thing. It's not like when you go into like a character or something like that doing stand-up thing. Because usually if I go into like a character or something, I'm usually just improvising the whole thing. So it isn't like acting where it's like, you know, memorizing lines and, you know, there's a piece of tape on the floor. You have to stop at that. The camera's over here. You know, all of that in your head type of stuff that tends to happen to me when I'm acting. Just stand-up is just stand-up. That's just me, you know, enhancing whatever I used to do at the cafeteria when I was in school. Just joking around, trying to make my friends laugh.
The cadence, though, in stand-up, as opposed to when you act, because acting is a whole lot of standing around, and then you got to get into what you have to get into, whereas stand-up, you start and you go. The difference between those two, how difficult was it to kind of ramp up for 60 seconds and then cool down for a while as opposed to stand-up?
I just sort of learned. I just shut up and I watch the people that know what they're doing. Like, I remember seeing Bryan Cranston when that Crawl Space episode, where he's laying in the bottom of the crawl space.
Walt, you gave our money to Benick.
Walt,
please, please just hear me out, please.
I always forget if he went from laughing to crying to laughing again or crying, laughing, crying. I don't know what it was, but it was unbelievable. But right before he went out to do it, he was talking to me about stand-up, just sitting in those actor chairs. And then he mentioned that, I think he said he tried stand-up a couple of times. And he was just, so how do you get your material, blah, blah, blah. They were like, all right, Brian, we're ready for you. And then he just went in and he did it. Like it was nothing. And then he came off the set, you know, after they were done shooting it and all the different angles. He just came, and I would just watch the whole thing like, how the hell did he do it? He comes off the set and he just immediately just picks it right back. So do you work the improvs? Are you more of a Laugh Factory guy? I was just like, wow. I didn't know. I knew these guys were good. I didn't know they were that good. But then I just sort of equated it to like, I could be like shooting the breeze with you right before going on in front of a huge crowd. I've just been doing it so long. So I really got inspired by his level of comfort.
I remember being on Jimmy Fallon's show, and right before he's ready to go on, he comes into the green room.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, he's the nicest guy in the world. And he's like, hey, I just want to make sure everything's okay and you like the decor in here. Now I can hear the music starting the show. And all of a sudden, he goes, hey, but I look forward to having you on the show. He walks out, he walks right onto the stage. And I was like, whoa, okay, I wasn't expecting that.
Yeah, but when you think about it, he gets 5 at-bats a week times 50 weeks a year. Times how many years he's been doing it for over a decade. I mean, that's like, you know, I just think it becomes second nature. He did that the other night. I was doing a benefit, the Pete Davidson's 9/11 benefit at Madison Square Garden. Madison Square Garden, place is packed. And he walked right by my dressing room. He's like, hey, man, shoots this, you know, breeze with me. And then all of a sudden he's like, oh, I got to go. Just goes right on stage, grabs a guitar, murders. Thanks a lot, everybody. See you. It's just like. But that might be his pregame ritual. Like he doesn't want to sit there and think.
When's the last time you went, I do not want to follow that comedian?
Oh, yeah, that happened recently. It might have been at the 9/11 thing because it was sort of murderer's row that they had put together. And I remember Colin Quinn murdered. I mean, I'm talking, I was like, I don't know how many, 100, 200 feet away from the stage. Sounded like a jet landing out there. Colin Quinn, New York City, Madison Square Garden, 9/11 benefit. I mean, that's like T-ball for that guy. So he was just going upper deck with every laugh. And I was just like, all right, okay, I guess this isn't going to be a friendly.
How do you approach it when you get a script for a movie role?
All right, early on, I would panic. And I would be literally reading the script, muttering, no more me, no more me, no more me. Because I knew the anxiety I was going to have before everything. And then and I was actually rooting for the fewest lines. I didn't want any monologues. I was just so afraid of the whole thing. It was just so outside my comfort zone. And I so hated myself and I had self-loathing and all of this. It was weird. It was like, I wanted it. And I also didn't want it all at the same time. And then, you know, I started getting positive feedback, people saying, hey, you know, you're doing a good job or whatever. And then I started to gradually start to enjoy the process. And now what it is when I get a script is I really need to know before every scene where we are in the story, because I'm embarrassed to say, like, you know, my first, I don't know how many acting gigs, there was no moment before. There was no, I was just like, they say action, I say this. So there was, I forget what actor I watched. If I was working with them, I was watching a show. The arc that they built in this sort of like, they were like the fourth or fifth person in the movie. They weren't really the major person. And I just really, once I got my head around how they shoot a lot of things where it's totally out of order, and you would see the person and be like, wow, so man, what if they shot the last thing first? And then he's got to sort of like re-backtrace it, as that guy said back in the day, like make this whole thing. And I got into that. I got into people that would do lines the opposite way of the way that they were written. Like if it seemed like really angry and all that, they would kind of be more laid back and smiling. And then they would maybe hit you on the happy line with the anger or something like that, just to make it like, you know, aside from just obviously, well, that would be more interesting than what somebody would obviously do. It's also a lot like how real life is, because people, a lot of times in heightened emotions, you're trying to hide your ulterior motive. So if you're really pissed, sometimes you're kind of acting like you're happy, I guess, because you're trying to get information out of the other person. And then my buddy Joe DeRosa told me he saw this interview with John Travolta, and he was talking about all the classic characters he did, and all he was doing was the walks. And he was like, Vinnie Barbarino walked like this, Vincent Vega walked like that. And he was like, dude, he even does the walks. And we were both sat there talking about how much we stink at acting. And we just laughed, and I go, dude, every character I've ever done always walks exactly like I do. I never thought to do a walk. There's that many layers to this, so I still feel like I'm really green and just sort of learning all of this stuff. But I do have a distinct advantage in that I can sell tickets as a comedian. So I can really wait for something good to come along. And usually the good stuff pays less money. One of the fascinating things I found in life is choosing the money and doing the right thing never seem to be the same thing. I don't know. Here's $1 million and you're helping the environment. It's never that. It's always like, well, you could have your hot tub and your flat screens, but next generation's going to have 130 degree days, you know? Yeah, I've been having a lot of fun with it lately.
You get intimidated with professionally trained actors?
Yes. It's just, yes, I do.
Can you fake it?
Yeah, that used to happen when I do stand up on Letterman. He was so imposing and the studio was so cold. I had to actually work up a certain level of hatred for him, like fake hatred, just so I could do the show. I'd have to be like, you know, F this guy for having the studio so effing cold and blah, blah, blah. Oh, I sit at a desk. And I would literally have to get in that mindset and lie to myself that I didn't care about him and I didn't want his approval, just so I could go out there and function.
Wow.
Then, of course, after I'd have a good set and he'd come over and I would turn into a puddle again and I could have my real emotions that, you know, he was my Carson.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I did a movie early on and I had to do some scenes and it was Al Pacino and Christopher Walken. And I was just, and I remember I went down to the set, I did my fitting and Fisher Stevens was the director. He said, hey, you want to meet the guys? And I was like, yes. But in my head, I was like, no. I went over, and fortunately, they were really warm, nice guys. Thank God. I kind of had the advantage of being a comedian because a lot of actors find stand-up fascinating. So they want to ask questions about it and everything. It's funny because they think like what we do takes more courage than what they do. And I always tell them, dude, it's the opposite. Because I write what I do. So I can keep myself within the lines of what I'm comfortable with. You know what I mean? Where like, I get an acting gig and it can just be like, okay, you have to go up and sing, or like you got to dance with this person, or you got to like this scene, you have to take your shirt off. I'm like, in a movie? I barely want to do that in front of my wife. I mean, it's just, that's the funnest thing about acting is when you get those things, you just have to push through it and you push through it. And then of course you end up having fun. And then you think to yourself, why was I afraid to do that? And like stuff, oh, you got to have your shirt off or something like that. I just think of Will Ferrell. Like Will Ferrell ran naked down the street in Old School. And I heard as a joke, he refused to wear a robe in between takes. I don't know if that's true or not, but I just remember thinking like, oh man, it's just like, it just made me feel like such a coward. So, you know, this whole thing trying to make it in this business is a very solitary thing where you have to constantly be confronted with your fears. So what I started to do was I just started, anytime there was an obstacle, I just found people in this business that faced the same thing or worse. Like when I started to lose my hair, all of a sudden I'm like, Ed Harris, man, Ed Harris. And I was just looking at all of those guys. And I'm like, that guy crushes it. They still want to work with them. Ed Asner's been bald since the 50s. The guy's won like 1,000, you know, rest his soul, he's won all these Emmys. And I just was like, and then I also kind of learned that if you try to hide your weakness, they smell it and you don't get the gig. But if you steer into it, steering into your weaknesses and try to make them strengths or whatever. So that's kind of what I've been doing.
But like King of Staten Island, there's romance there. It's a little bit different for you. You know, there's some skin being shown there.
Yeah.
How different is that as opposed to just acting in The Mandalorian?
Oh, yeah. Well, that one was, because that was the first time there was like, you know, on-screen kiss and all of that. I was terrified for that. And I finally be like, Bill, you've kissed a woman before on a first date. Okay. This is the same thing. Just do that and it'll be fine. And that fortunately, Marissa was, you know, she was like a total, such like a ridiculous pro. I remember before the scene, she goes, Judd, It's just like a kiss, or is this like a kiss? And he goes, it's like a kiss. She's like, all right.
Thank you for letting him do this, right?
I didn't do anything. I just sat there. He did all the work. You like going over the spine, didn't you?
Took it like a champ.
Sat there wincing.
Oh, my God. Can we at least close the curtain?
Guys, people die in here, all right?
Oh, my God.
She was just like wide open. I've only worked with a couple people that were like that, where they're just like, what switch do I need to throw here? Am I crying? Okay. And then she'd be like, oh, come on. I was there. I remember she said that one time. I was there. He's like, sorry. And they go back to one. And I would be like, I was there. Now I'm going to be thinking, I was there. Why didn't he go? And then you lose it. And then they'd be like, all right. And then she would just ramp it back up again. Like, it was literally like whatever you wanted, she could just push the button. So then I kind of had to like block that out. I was just like, all right, she's way better than I am. Obviously, but...
But, you know, that first kiss you have is not on camera in real life.
Yes.
This, you're thinking, how do I make this kiss look like a real kiss?
Oh, my God. That's right. He used, when Judd yelled, he goes, what? She goes, is this a kiss or like a kiss? And Judd used one of, the most disgusting expressions in the English language. He goes, you're post-coital. I don't know what it is about that, but it's like you just sucked on a coital. Ugh. So... I would have liked it better if you, like, you just banged, but you can't say that anymore. So you got to go like, you got to sound like a meteorologist when you're talking about sex. You're post-coital.
How did you look on the big screen, though, when you're watching yourself?
Oh, I hate doing that. I say to myself, other people watch this and I didn't get fired. So it's not as bad as you think.
What'd your wife think?
About the movie? Oh, she was a big fan. My wife acts too, so she gets the whole thing.
Okay.
I watched a cut with it with Pete, who's the reason I was in the movie, Pete Davidson. I watched a cut of it. The movie was flowing and all of that. And it was a big deal because that was the biggest part I ever had. So I was sort of outside myself, just kind of looking at him like, this is working. Is this good? I don't know what this is. I'm just going, it's just a weird thing to watch yourself. Like you should never be looking at the side of your head while watching yourself talk. It's just like a bizarre experience, which I try to avoid at all costs.
Is there fear of failure or fear of success for you?
No, failure. Definitely failure. Just bombing and everybody being like, oh, so this was all BS. You stink. Go back to unloading trucks in the warehouse or whatever. And I lucked out where my wife is. My wife's a better actor than I am. I think she's funnier than I am, too. She's hilarious. And she's, I told her, the anxieties that I had throughout. She helps me get through a lot of stuff. You know, the day before I went in for my week at SNL, I had an absolute friggin' meltdown. I was like, this is too big. I don't want to do this. I just want to do my jokes and be left alone. Like, I really just went back to who I was when I first started. And she talked me off the ledge. And then I just sort of thought to myself, do I really want to put her through this all week? You know, the person acting like they're going to jump and they're not. You know you're going to do the gig. So I just made this mental note, like, I don't need to be nervous until 11:45 Saturday night. That's the only time, okay? Then I can be nervous. Until then, why don't you just enjoy the week? And ended up having, like, the best time. So hopefully I learned that and I can quit torturing myself.
All right, that's all my time. We got a great show for you guys, everybody. Jack White is here. It's going to be amazing. Please stick around. We'll be right back.
What's that like when you have a joke that leaves you the last word and it gets to the audience and then you know it's not going over? How long does that time period feel like?
Used to feel like forever early on. You just learn how to gracefully, like bomb gracefully, you know, you just make fun of yourself. You blame the crowd. I'm a big fan of that. That's not my fault. It's your fault. if you're doing stand up in a place where you're not comfortable, it feels like a kick in the chest. It's something you have to shake off quick or the crowd will smell it and then you go down in flames. So I used to feel that a lot in front of any crowd. And then I got comfortable in front of crowds, meaning basically white crowds. And then when I went to New York and I also started doing the Uptown Rooms, which were the black shows, when something didn't go over, there was the uncomfortableness that it bombed. And then also the uncomfortableness of like, I'm white, they're black. There's a culture thing here. My people have done horrible things to your people. Is the payback tonight? And what I always enjoyed about a black crowd was I learned early on that no matter what, they're having fun. They're even going to have fun with you or without you. So if you got the jokes, they will laugh with you. If you don't, they're laughing at you. And then you become, they become the comedians. So it was.
When does your double album come out?
Yes, I have a double album. I'm doing a record signing here in LA and I'm going to be putting it out. And this is like the full hour for my, that Paper Tiger special. This is where my act was about 4 months before at Madison Square Garden. There's the whole thing where I make fun of the whole support the troops thing, firemen being heroes and all of that. I did it in England, but it fell flat the night of the taping because there was a terrorist incident. And for some reason, nobody told me that, so I couldn't really adjust to it. So it just didn't quite click. And then it also made the special just a little too long. So we took it out, slammed it together and did the, you know, the old school show business, leave them wanting more rather than wearing them out. Well, this is the wear you out 90-minute special. So there's a whole side of the record that isn't even on my special, but I put it out on vinyl because I'm a vinyl guy. I love all old stuff, you know, Me TV. I love all the old stuff, pull tab, beer cans and stuff. But it's also because it is so much of the same material. I just wanted, like, you got to be like a rabid fan to stand up to buy this thing. So there's a limited amount, but it's super high quality. Like the sound of it is incredible. The laughs and everything. Because I tried to record there before and they went straight from the mixing board. And it sounded like I was playing like the Village Underground. It didn't have that Madison Square Garden sound.
My two brothers-in-law are former firemen, New York City firemen. Can you indulge us with the fireman joke?
What was the fireman joke? It had something to do with about them being heroes and on all of that stuff. And I was saying, like, you know, when I was a kid, a fireman was a guy, you know, who smoked cigars, banged hookers, and then stole stuff after a fire. Everything burned up in the fire. You'd have a fire in your house. Be like, hey, man, I had some cash in the garage. Ah, the embers. The embers floated out there right into your shirt pocket. So, you know, it was like the Star Wars thing where all these people love Star Wars. I'm going to make fun of it. And all of these people are saying, you know, like, oh, these guys are heroes. It's like, yeah, or they flunked everything in high school and had no options. I don't think every one of them is sitting here going like, I must defend, you know.
Has anybody fought you before, challenged you before?
Like literally a physical altercation?
Yeah.
No, I've had a lot of mock charges. I remember this guy with loafers and no socks in the original Punchline in Atlanta. An arrogant ass. He was sitting in the front row and he had his stupid bare feet in his loafers on the stage with his legs crossed and just sitting like that. You know, so I say, hey, do you mind taking your feet off the stage? He goes, why? They're not doing anything. And then immediately I'm like, oh, you're that guy. You're always the center of attention, aren't you? Right? You're always the center of attention. And you can't handle the fact that your woman is now going to watch me for 60 minutes and be funnier than you've ever been. Look at you. You're hanging on to this relationship by the skin of your teeth. You know, it's all money based. Look at her. What is she, 15, 20 years younger? I mean, there was other stuff that happened. And I remember they finally threw him out and I was standing there and the mic stand was here. And when they went to kick him out, rather than going down the aisle, he stood up onto the stage. Like his last little, I could tell the guy never had a fight in his life because he was sort of coming at me, but his arms were down by his sides. And I'm like, all right. And then I had the mic. You always have the mic stand. It's a great blunt object. It's got the metal base on it. You know, you want to get him in the chest and then get that top circle to hit right here. That'll stop anybody in loafers. I learned that in the one self-defense class I ever took. I don't know if that's jujitsu or aikido.
Hey, good luck with the tour and that blossoming acting career there.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. I hope people still care enough to come see me because I got a whole new hour and 30 minutes of ignorance that I will be doing around the country, especially next year and everything. So thank you for having me on.
Billy, great to talk to you again. Thank you.
All right, Dan. Thanks, buddy.
New episodes of That Scene are available exclusively on Amazon Music, and all of Season 1 is available wherever you get your podcasts, so make sure you follow us in the Amazon Music app. That Scene with Dan Patrick, created, hosted, produced by me. Our showrunner and producer is Brendan Pike. The show is executive produced by Paul Anderson, Nick Pinella, and Andrew Greenwood. Edited by Jordan Fair. Our associate producers, Bill Ryan and Marvin Prince. That Scene is an Amazon original and a production of Dan Patrick Productions.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to That Scene with Dan Patrick ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.